It's my great pleasure to welcome you all to this last and final plenary session of ECCP 2018. As you see, we have now a large auditorium for almost 1,200 people available for this plenary. And this is because this is an open plenary lecture for general public, and I hope there are people from Jyväskylä and around attending this plenary session. It's my great pleasure to introduce our plenary speaker, Will Steffen. In my opening words on Tuesday, I referred to the concept of Anthropocene without properly defining the concept. It's therefore a great pleasure to introduce Will Steffen, because he's a person who has strongly been influencing spreading the work about the concept Anthropocene, and particularly the planetary boundary concept. And today, his talk is entitled The Anthropocene, Planetary Boundaries and the Biosphere, Challenges for the 21st Century. Will is an Earth system scientist. His research interests span a broad range within the fields of climate and Earth system science, with an emphasis on incorporation of human processes in Earth system modeling and analysis, and particular focus on sustainability and climate change. Will is a counselor on the publicly funded Climate Council of Australia that delivers independent expert information about climate change. He's also an emeritus professor at the Australian National University in Canberra. He seems to have very strong connections to Sweden, so it's good to have him here in Finland as well. He's a senior fellow at the Stockholm Resilience Centre, Sweden, and a fellow at the Pier Institute of Ecological Economics, also in Sweden, Stockholm, Sweden. He's the chair of the jury for the Volvo Environment Prize, and a member of International Advisory Board for the Center for Collective Action Research, which is in Gothenburg, Sweden. And from 1998 till mid-2004, he served as the executive director of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, also based in Sweden. So we'll very well, warmly welcome. We are eagerly waiting for your plenary.
Thank you very much for that kind invitation, introduction, and thanks for the invitation to come to Jyväskylä. It's a real pleasure. I have been in Finland before, but not out of Helsinki, so it's really nice to get up country a bit and see this lovely land. What I'm going to talk about today is where our planet is headed, the role of humanity with a focus on the biosphere. And of course, it's important to remember that we are part of the biosphere. We evolved into the biosphere. We're still embedded in it, although sometimes we think we somehow have moved outside of it. I'm going to talk really in three parts, so this is a bit of a roadmap for where I'm going to go. I'm going to start with this concept of the Anthropocene with some more particular comments about the role of the biosphere and the fate of the biosphere in the Anthropocene. And then I'll talk about Earth system dynamics. How does the planet operate and where is it going? Finally, planetary boundaries, which is a concept that tries to connect how we are changing the planet, how we're changing the Earth system, and where are the limits to keeping a stable Earth system. So let's dive in now and start with a concept that will be right throughout my entire talk, and that's that the Earth is a system. And I use that in the singular. There's no S there. There's lots of systems within it. We have economic systems and we have ecological systems. We have circulation systems in the ocean and the atmosphere. But all of those are intertwined, and they form one single system that when you look at the Earth from space, you can intuitively see it. But when you study it, you see that it has properties that are emergent of the entire system, not just the biosphere, not just the geosphere, but the entire Earth system. To understand this, we need to go right back to the beginning. So this is in the vertical axis is time. So we start here at 4.5 billion years ago when Earth was formed. But the interesting thing here is you can really understand Earth by this beautiful dance together between the geosphere, the non-living part of Earth, and the biosphere, the living part. The biosphere originated as long as 4 billion years ago. So it's been with us on planet Earth for most of the history of Earth. But the interesting thing is that it wasn't a case of the geosphere somehow magically providing the conditions for life. Once life formed as bacterial organisms, it sort of grabbed control of the planet and really helped drive the evolution in this beautiful interaction between the geosphere and the biosphere. There are many cases of where the biosphere has really played an important part in massive changes. I'll just point out two of them. One is the so-called Great Oxidation Event about 2.5 billion years ago. And that's important for us because we wouldn't exist without an atmosphere of about 20% oxygen. And since that time, for half of Earth's existence, the biosphere has maintained the composition of the atmosphere. So if you like, the atmosphere is a wholly owned subsidiary of the biosphere. It controls it. Then more recently, when we go up, So when we go up here, more recently, the last 500 million years, the interesting thing is when you look at the sun, the solar energy, it's been going up. The sun's been getting more intense over the last billion years or so. But the last 500 million years or so, the Earth's temperature has gone down. Why is that so? That's because of the terrestrial biosphere, the land biosphere, that only really got going 500 million years ago. As plants began to absorb more and more CO2 and store it in the soil, it drew down the atmospheric composition of CO2, and that helped to cool the planet to the one we have today. So the biosphere has been really, really important in how the Earth has evolved. Now let's just jump into the contemporary period, the period that's important for us humans. Here's the last 400,000 years. This is an ice core record from the Australian Antarctic Territory way down south. And this red line is a proxy for temperature, global average temperature. And as you can see, this a very regular pattern of warm interglacials and long cold glacial periods, operating at about 100,000-year periodicity. So for us humans, it's important because modern humans evolved about halfway through that record, about 200,000 to 250,000 years ago. But for most of that time, we've been hunter-gatherers in small groups of people, first in Africa, and then spreading around to other parts of the planet. And it's only this last about 11,000 or so years, called the Holocene, that we've begun to develop agriculture, settlements, more complex societies, the societies we are enjoying today. So let's just look at that last bit in a little bit more detail. There's the last 100,000 years when the Earth was coming into an ice age. You can see how erratic and jagged. It's colder, it's drier, much more difficult for humans. And then we see this sharp rise of starting about 20,000 years ago at the last glacial maximum up until the last 11,700 years. And the geologists call this the Holocene, the most recent epoch in Earth's history. So that's the background for what's happening now in just the last few centuries. So if we look at what's happening now, we can see that there are massive changes. So when I was with the IGBP, we were wondering, how were we going to try to map out what really was happening? We had all sorts of data, masses of data, that the Earth was changing. We had masses of data that humans were somehow implicated. This wasn't natural variability. So we tried to systematize this. So what we did was we picked out 12 indicators. If you had to somehow describe humanity, who we are, how many we are, what we do, this might be what you would do. You'd have population, economy, energy use, urbanization, resource use, communication, transport, and so on. We started these graphs, each one of them at the year 1750, because we wanted to start before the Industrial Revolution. And we thought that would be important because we had an idea that it was really when humanity started industrializing that we saw all these impacts. What we didn't anticipate was the shape of these curves. We expected lines that pretty much went up linearly from 1750 to the present. They didn't, not at all. There was very little activity in most of these indicators until the mid-20th century, till the around 1950. And then many of them simply exploded. Big rates of, big increases in the rates of change, population, GDP, and so on. So something unusual was happening. And of course, social scientists have written some really wonderful books. John McNeill's book, Something New Under the Sun, goes into a lot of detail of why humanity really exploded. And it wasn't so much technology, it was more the social side. It was new institutions, new ways of organizing economies, and so on. But as Earth system scientists, we asked ourselves, that's really interesting, but of course, this is a really big planet we're on, so does this make any difference at all to planet Earth? So we did the same thing. We did 12 indicators for the Earth system as to how it was changing, again from 1750. So you can see the famous greenhouse gases. There's climate, ozone, ocean acidification. The bottom six are the biosphere. So the top six are the geosphere, the bottom six are the biosphere, and their responses to humans in the oceans, in the coastal zones, and in the land. So when you look at that, whether it's the geosphere or changes to the biosphere, again, you see things happening around about 1950. Not so smoothly, but certainly somewhere in the 20th century. And when we looked at all the data that went behind those graphs, we could say two things for certain about them. One is the Earth system was no longer in the Holocene. All 12 of these are outside of Holocene norms. So taken together, this is probably the single most aggregated set of information that tell you that Earth has left the Holocene. So then the second question is, why would the Earth leave the Holocene? If you look at the orbital parameters, Earth's orbit around the Sun, the Holocene should be a long interglacial. It should go for another 20 or 30,000 years. But it's not. It's changing fast. And of course, the second thing we found out is each of those 12, the primary driver is human activity. So it was clear to us that the human activity was driving the Earth system as a single complex system out of the Holocene. Now, this gentleman here happened to be on the IGBP steering committee when we were producing these graphs and discussing them. His name is Paul Crutzen. He's a Nobel laureate. He won his Nobel Prize for his work on the ozone hole, so he's an expert atmospheric chemist and so on. But at that time, we were sort of looking at all these graphs and analyzing them, and our paleoscientists were going back in time, talking about the Holocene this and the Holocene that. And Paul got agitated. He got really upset, and he just sort of jumped up and said, you know, you got to stop saying the Holocene, because we're not in the Holocene anymore. We're in the, and he hadn't actually thought of a word at that time. So just sort of at the moment, he said, we're in the Anthropocene, Anthropo being human, scene being a geological time interval, which he proposed then should be at the epoch level and should replace the Holocene. So the origin of the Anthropocene was in early 2000 at a scientific meeting of the IGBP, and Paul Crutzen was the originator of it. So let's now focus in on the biosphere rather than the geosphere. There's been an enormous amount of work and information and discussion about climate change, which of course is really embedded in the geosphere, and I will mention climate change a little bit later. But again, it's important to realize that over most of Earth history, 4 billion years, this has been as important as the geosphere in guiding the planetary system, what states it's in, how it changes, and so on. So I'll focus just a few minutes now on what has happened to the biosphere. You people know it much better at small scales, but this is the long-term planetary scale. How is life changing? Well, first thing we can see is we've had 5 great extinction events in Earth history. So if you look at them down here, they're normally defined by 75% or greater loss in major forms of life in terms of the number of species. Well, if we go, I'll just go back here a moment. If we look at where we are today, for many different types of species, the IUCN threatened status says many of them are pushing out toward well above background levels and pushing toward that 75% level. So we're not there yet, but the point is, if we keep going, we'll be there in a couple of human lifetimes. So right now, the extinction rates, I've seen estimates of tens to hundreds. Some people say 1,000 times background level. Whatever it is, it's well above, by a couple orders of magnitude, what the background level is. This is even more striking. This is a very simple image put together by Vaclav Smil about 15 or so years ago. He's a Canadian scientist. What he did was take the biomass of everything that has a backbone that lives on land, every vertebrate. So it's mammals, it's birds, amphibians, reptiles, and add up the entire biomass of all of us. Nearly one-third, 32%, is just us, our body weight. We're about a third of the biomass. But when you add in our domesticates, our chickens, our pigs, our cattle, dogs, what have you, that's another 65%. So you can do the sums, and you've only got 3% left for all the vertebrate wildlife on the planet. This is really a good visual picture of what the Anthropocene is all about. We completely dominate the terrestrial biosphere, at least for the vertebrate part, probably not for the bacterial part. There's the Anthropocene chicken. Okay, so this is a chook in 1957. When I was a lad growing up, that's what a chicken looked like, and it weighed a little under 1 kilogram. Okay, well, here you go, it's 1978. There's the massive mega chicken of 2005, nearly 5 times as heavy as a chicken ought to be. Now, the stratigraphers are interested in this because you can see a change in the bone structure, in the wishbone and in the thigh bone between this chicken and this chicken. And these bones are accumulating in the strata. So that's going to be one of many, many markers that are already being investigated in the stratigraphic record of the Anthropocene. Mark Williams and colleagues have published a really interesting paper looking at the biosphere from a really longer-term perspective and saying, what is different about the Anthropocene biosphere? Global homogenization of flora and fauna. We're mixing species all around the planet, directly through our domesticates and ourselves, and indirectly through a lot of things that come along with us. We're commandeering somewhere between 25 and 40% of the net primary productivity of the land surface of the planet. Estimates vary on that, but it's certainly a big number. And we're mining fossil NPP. Fossil fuels are net primary productivity that's been stored underground for a long time, and releasing that. Human-directed evolution of other species, increasing as we become clever and clever at manipulating genetic codes and so on. Increasing interaction of the biosphere with the technosphere, the technical part of human society, which is increasing enormously. So these authors said this is really the beginning or signs of a new third stage of evolution of the biosphere. The first one being bacterial life, single cell life and so on. The second one being the metazoans, the larger creatures like plants and animals and so on. And they argue that when they look back geologically, what is happening now in the Anthropocene is so significant that it's going to be the third major stage in the evolution of Earth's biosphere. This is quite a remarkable suggestion that we could be changing the biosphere so much that when creatures of some sort from Earth or somewhere else look back on this planet in another few hundred million years or billion years, they will see another big shift from bacterial to metazoan to Anthropocene. Well, the stratigraphers, of course, have to get into the act because Paul Crutzen challenged them to say, you know, this should be really identified as a new geological epoch. And they have a very, very clear way of judging if it is or it isn't. They ask this question, have humans changed the Earth system such that geological deposits forming now and in the recent past include a fingerprint distinct from that of the Holocene? So in other words, they've got to go down in the strata and see some sharp changes. It has to be globally synchronous, has to be clearly different from the Holocene. And if so, when has the change become recognizable worldwide? Been working for about a decade now, the Anthropocene Working Group, which is a formal body under the International Commission for Stratigraphy. Jan Zolasevich at Leicester in the UK is the chair of this, and he recently summarized what the 35 members of the working group actually have come up with so far. Pretty clear, stratigraphic signatures of human origin are well above Holocene norms, In other words, they can already see them in the strata. And it will leave a lasting signature. The evidence is most consistent with those graphs I showed you. A mid-20th century starting date would be the most logical, because that's what's lining up with the stratigraphic record around the world. And now they're looking at specific cores. The geological timescale relies, at least in its more recent time periods, in something called a GSSP, or a golden spike, a single core, which is representative of a whole lot of other cores around the planet. The one for the Holocene is interesting because that core is actually an ice core, not a bit of rock. It's an ice core from Greenland, and the spike, the magic spike, or the golden spike, is when atmospheric carbon dioxide stabilized at about 280 parts per million. It was about 180 at the depth of the ice age. So it went up 100 ppm. And that's the start of the Holocene. That ice core is actually in an ice lab in Copenhagen, Denmark. So you can go see that golden spike. So what about the Anthropocene? Well, we've got a lot of choices. So these are some of the things that the stratigraphers are looking at. Aluminium, concrete, plastics. You could add radionuclides. You could add fossilized remains of creatures that have been changed by human activity, and so on. So there's a wealth of possible indicators that we could use. But if you look at this again, here's 1950, and you can see that most of these materials that are completely human, no mistake about it, they only started accumulating about the mid-20th century and so on. So that work will take another 3 years or so, and then the International Commission on Stratigraphy will be asked to formalize the Anthropocene. So that was a bit of a diversion, but it's really interesting to see how Earth system science, ecological biospheric sciences, social sciences, and the geological sciences are all coming together. All right, let me shift gears a bit now and talk a little bit about the Earth system, so I will go a little bit into climate here. That's a 2,000-year record of global average surface temperature. So that's the Roman Empire you see here on the left, and you can see that there's natural variability for sure, but within well-defined bounds, a very, very, very slow cooling trend of about a hundredth of a degree per century. This on the end is the human influence since the Industrial Revolution, but really, again, since 1900 and especially since 1950. So you can see it's remarkable. And when you actually look at the rate of this, we're now increasing temperature at about 1.7 degrees per century on average. So that's 170 times faster than the background rate. And some of the papers I heard today were obviously talking about how climate change was starting to influence the biosphere, whether it's individual species or so on. It's not a surprise because the biosphere is adapted to rates of change that look like that, not like that. Now, if you look in the future, these are the climate model projections of the IPCC, and we're going out here now to 2100. The blue is the lowest emission trajectory. The red is the highest emission trajectory. And when you just look at a century and a half, that doesn't look too impressive. It's going from zero to about 4 degrees, and it looks like some gradual change that we can perhaps deal with. But when you put this on the same time scale, on this time scale here, you see how dramatic it is. That's it. So when you look at that, this is 1900, 2000, 2100. That's about a degree and a half. That's the Paris targets in here. And there's four or five high emission scenarios. So imagine that the biosphere now has to, it's had about a nearly 12,000 year period, which looks like this, and now it's hit with this. And on top of it, there are direct human pressures that you know more about than I do on the biosphere. And of course, humans being part of the biosphere, we're going to be hit with this too. So the question is, we're pretty much committed to somewhere between 1.5 and 2. There'll be a lot of heroic statements made by the IPCC over the coming months about, well, we might still be able to get to 1.5, but it would take a massive effort. More realistic is we can hope to hold the temperature rise to about 2 degrees. But this one, 4 to 5 degrees, which is the high emission scenario, this is a really dangerous one because there are a lot of commentators there saying that human societies, as complex and powerful as we are going to have trouble coping with that level of change. and a global collapse of our contemporary civilization is not out of the question. It would be a credible risk at that level. I want to talk a little bit now. I'm going to bring the biosphere right back into this, because I was telling you that the biosphere has actually not just been a passenger in the Earth system, it's been a controller for 4 billion years, and it still is. So one of the things we're looking at now in the climate science community is tipping points, somewhere between 2 and 4 degrees. In other words, is there a risk that the Earth system, including the biosphere, will take the system out of human control? And if we start hitting tipping points, it may go up to 4 or 5, even if we get emissions down. It's a very, very important question. That's one of active research now. So what do these tipping points look like? A lot's been done on them in the last 10 or 15 years in terms of research. They come in 3 different types: melting of ice, obviously mainly at the poles, also in the Himalaya; circulation change in the ocean, in the atmosphere; and very importantly, biome change or biome loss. The important biomes are pumps in the ocean that bring carbon down, big land biomes, the Amazon forest, and where we actually sit right now, the boreal forest in the northern high latitudes, coral reefs, and so on. So a lot of work has been done on those in the last few years. I'm just going to talk about one of them in detail, because the Amazon forest has probably been studied more than any other one. And that's an interesting one, because the rainfall that keeps that as a lush tropical forest comes about 50% from the ocean, from the Atlantic Ocean, advected in. The other 50% is recycled. It's evaporation from the forest itself, which then comes back down and falls as rain. So the tipping point could operate like this. Climate change changes ocean atmosphere circulation, and most of the climate models predict reduced rainfall from the ocean for the Amazon region, increased drought. That would tend to induce dieback of the forest, starting at the drier edges, fire, and conversion to savannas and dry forest. But then if we look at the human side, humans are changing the Amazon directly. In fact, the major impact so far isn't yet climate, it's this, it's deforestation by human activities, conversion of that forest into cropland or pasture. This reduces evaporation and reduces this internal cycling of water. So you got a double whammy for the Amazon. You're losing recycled water because you're losing forest, and you're starting to lose water coming in from the ocean. So when you do the sums, deforestation alone, even if we didn't have climate change, there would be a tipping point, we reckon, somewhere at 20 to 25%. So the Amazon now is a bit under 15%. So it's heading up toward that level. Climate change alone, if you had a perfectly pristine forest, 3 to 4 degrees would probably tip the Amazon into something much drier. But when you put the two together, the Paris 2-degree target would reduce allowable deforestation significantly less than 25%, down to somewhere between 15 and 20, we reckon. And it's sitting about 15 now. The Paris commitments, in other words, what all the countries said they would do after the Paris meeting, will take you to about 3 degrees. This would reduce allowable deforestation to near zero. So we've got a real problem with the Amazon, in that it's got this double whammy of a warming climate and a drying climate in that region, and it's got increasing deforestation. So you might say, well, if we're getting that close, shouldn't we see some problems? And indeed, we are seeing some problems. I want to point out, though, that this is not just an isolated problem. In terms of the Earth system, if you deforest the Amazon in a climate model, which is what is done here, so you deforest it, you get a big temperature increase, pretty obviously there, because you're dropping evapotranspiration, which cools the air. But it leads to cooling in the Mediterranean region, and it leads to an incredible increase in heat through Central and East Asia, including some of the big agricultural areas in China. So that's why this system, this Earth system issue, is really important, that you have teleconnections right around. And interestingly, we actually have a really good idea of the processes. You can see all the way through the processes that change in terms of atmospheric circulation, in terms of other patterns of circulation in the ocean, because you deforest the Amazon. And you end up, surprisingly, with 2 or 3 degrees additional surface warming in East Asia, which could make it really hard for people to live there. So this is a real interconnected single system with really important parts. and the Amazon is certainly one of them. So, if you look at what's happening in the Amazon, they've had two big droughts in 2005, 2010, mainly climate-driven, and they've had fires go along with those droughts. Lost about 10 years. In those two droughts in 2 years, they've lost about 10 years of carbon storage. So again, this is the point I'm making. This goes back up to the atmosphere, and it's additional carbon. That's about 1 year's worth of human emissions. There's been another severe drought just recently in 2015, 2016. If you look up here at the boreal forest, probably the best data we've got at a fairly large scale is some of the Canadian data. And what we're seeing here, you just need to look at this curve. This is the carbon balance of the Canadian boreal forest from about 1920, when the Canadian foresters have really good data. And it was a pretty good carbon sink. In other words, it was absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere, storing it in the forest. But as the climate was shifting, there was a combination of insect infestations. Bark beetles, spruce bark beetles, were attacking the forest, weakening them. And as it got hotter and drier, fires came through, and they started losing carbon. And interestingly, it was a very steep decline. Till late in the 20th century, the Canadian forests were actually a net source of carbon back to the atmosphere. So here's an example of where the biosphere is acting as a very strong feedback because it's being destabilized by the initial push from human-driven climate change. Biosphere reacts, and in general, these big tipping points tend to push carbon back up into the atmosphere and amplify the climate change. So some of the work we've just done now, we're just in the process of publishing, is like, how big can this effect be? So we asked ourselves the question, if we meet the Paris 2-degree target, how big are these feedbacks going to be? Well, we think the Amazon dieback could release about 25 billion tons through this century, and we think the boreal forest is even a bit bigger. It could release 30 billion tons from the processes that I just described. If we go to higher temperatures, like 3 degrees, these numbers would go up quite a bit. This also does not include human-driven deforestation. This is just climate-driven. So to give you an idea of how big those numbers are, human emissions are about 10 billion tons of carbon a year. So that represents 5 to 6 years of human emissions. So, and if you look at other processes in the biosphere, you can get even bigger numbers of carbon coming back up. So, the problem is this, is these tipping points do not act independently. So you see you've got some of the ice there, you've got the Amazon, you've got the boreal, you've got some circulation changes. We've been able now to start to pin down where are these vulnerable in terms of temperature rise. And you see these light yellow ones are 1 to 3 degrees. Coral reefs, well, I can tell you the Great Barrier Reef off Australia is in not very good condition now at even 1 degree temperature rise. It's basically probably on its deathbed after two big bleaching events. So at 1.5, it's going to be gone. West Antarctic ice sheet, you may have seen a paper in Nature that came out this week. Over the past less than a decade, a tripling in the rate of ice loss from West Antarctica. And some climate scientists are thinking we're approaching a tipping point there. Arctic summer sea ice, 1 to 3 degrees as well. We've probably crossed that tipping point. So we've got a series of ice-related tipping points that are really vulnerable at low temperature rises. Then when you hit 3 to 5, you start getting a lot of features here in the mid-latitudes and in the tropics. Amazon rainforest, boreal forest, circulation changes, thermohaline circulation. This is important for Scandinavia, for Finland, because this would mean shutting down that warm current that comes up along the Norwegian coast, and that would act to cool climates up here in opposition to the warming. And then 5 degrees, if we get up there, this is a big ticket item, permafrost. There's something on the order of 100 to 250 billion tons of carbon that could be vulnerable. That's 25 years of human emissions. And we may start destabilizing the East Antarctic ice sheet. That contains about 50 meters worth of sea level rise. So the idea is that the risk is, that as you start tipping elements in the 1 to 3 degree range, that'll raise the temperature up. You'll start tipping in the 3 to 5, and you get a cascade. So these are the processes in which a complex system actually operates when it goes from one state to a very different state. So the issue here is that we're pretty much committed to 2-degree warming. But if we go much above that, we could start activating all these tipping points, and that cascade would push you up. And it would push you up to somewhere between 4 and 5. So what we're arguing now, and this is really new research that we're just getting published as I'm speaking, is that there is a lot of sense to really making sure you meet those Paris targets. Because if you don't, we may eliminate these intermediate temperatures. They may not be accessible because of intrinsic tipping points in the Earth system, many of which are biospheric. And the Earth would go to a much hotter state. And by the way, in its recent past, it's been very happily for millions of years in a state of 4 to 5 degrees warmer and much higher sea levels. So that's not at all outside the realms of possibility. Okay, what can science do to help guide us to avoid tipping points, to avoid that sort of scenario? That's really the rationale for planetary boundaries. And one point I want to make is that planetary boundaries were never, ever designed to solve conservation issues at subglobal levels. They were designed for one thing and one thing only, and that is, what do we need to do to maintain the Earth in a Holocene-like state? Something that's close enough to the Holocene that we can survive. Or put bluntly, somewhere that doesn't go between 1.5 or 2 degrees and can somehow really turn around loss of biological diversity and biosphere integrity. That's what it was designed to do. So we asked ourselves back in 2007 when we first started thinking about this, what are the least number of really important processes that really can define the Earth system? So we wanted to make this really science-based one. We didn't want to say, what should societies do? How should they react to this? That's for societies to decide. And there could be many pathways we could stay within the planetary boundaries. But we call it a safe operating space because we think that if you stay within the planetary boundaries, there's a very low probability you'll destabilize the Earth system and move it onto those tipping points and up to another state. So that's the probably well-known diagram now that we published in 2015. And we use a simple traffic lights approach, that the safe operating space is the green. Outside the outer one, we think we've gone way past where the boundary ought to be. The boundary's actually in here. And then there's a zone of uncertainty. It's increasing risk, uncertainty about some of the science, and so on. We identified 9 boundaries. You see biosphere integrity here. Climate change, novel entities, that's new stuff like chemicals, radioactive materials, artificial intelligence, all sorts of stuff humans are shoving into the system. Land system change, freshwater use, biogeochemical flows, main elements, phosphorus, nitrogen, acidifying the ocean, aerosols in the atmosphere, stratospheric ozone. And we've had a lot of discussions and there's been a lot of criticism, but there really hasn't been any alternative configuration or any major changes in the number of these and what they are. But importantly, we now have identified 2 as overarching ones. These are the really important ones representing the geosphere and the biosphere. So it's consistent with the 4.5 billion year evolution of Earth. And that's climate change representing the geosphere and biosphere integrity representing the biosphere. And you can relate all of these others in some way or another to those 2. And the other point that's really, really critical is we think these are the only 2 which on their own would tip the Earth system into another state. We don't think you'll do it by changing these other parameters. You'll do it by eroding biosphere integrity on its own to such a low level that the Earth system will change state. Or, obviously, if you change climate so fast and so much, it will tip to another state. Of course, we're doing both. We're eroding biosphere integrity and warming the climate. Another misconception is that a boundary is a threshold. It's not. Some of the processes we think do have thresholds, but where they do have a threshold, the boundary is not placed at the threshold. It'd be pretty dumb to find out where a threshold is by crossing it. So you want to put the boundary upstream of the threshold. And so that's the rationale for those that do have thresholds, like ocean acidification is a good example. Many of them actually do not. And so what we're trying to do here is get a handle on how far can you push them before you start eroding the resilience of the planet as a whole. Those are much harder to define. And so we usually take a fairly conservative view. We do this on biosphere integrity, at where you should put the boundary. Biosphere integrity, well, the first indicator we just used was simply biodiversity loss in terms of extinction rates. But in the 2015 update, we've actually separated out into 2 things. genetic diversity and functional diversity. So genetic diversity, you can use species extinction rates, but getting back to real core genetics would be even better if we can do that. For functioning, we're using a biosphere intactness index, which was originated in southern Africa by some scholars. They're based on expert elicitation of how intact is the biosphere in that part of the world. We hope to make this global. Climate change, as I've said, is affected by biosphere integrity, obviously biodiversity, and there are a whole lot of other things that are more human. Indigenous cultures, human health, are all related to the intactness and good functioning of the biosphere. This is why it's one of the core planetary boundaries. It's a tough one, so maybe someone will come up with an even better indicator than BII. Hope so. The other thing is you look at all the other boundaries and you can see how they're related to the biosphere integrity boundary. It's a real integrator. And it's not surprising, given that it's been so important for the evolution of Earth, that it would be related to almost all these other boundaries. So it really is an important one. How can you measure current status? We don't have a good measurement for biosphere integrity other than the estimate for southern Africa. So what we use, this is mean species abundance. Some of you may have seen this. It's not an adequate indicator, but it actually is generally similar to lots of other maps I've seen, is where's the real pressure on the biosphere. It's coming from large agricultural zones. It's coming from heavily populated zones. The areas which are looking pretty good are generally very dry or generally very cold and not used by humans. There's land system change. We're looking at the three major biomes, temperate forests, boreal forests, tropical forests. We actually did these calculations probably in 2014. My guess is if we redid them, this would be yellow now. There's been further deforestation of the Amazon. It was just barely in the green area. The only other one that's pretty solidly in the green area is the temperate forest of North America, which is actually reforesting after a century or two of heavy deforestation. But all the other forests of the world are either well over the boundary in the red zone or over the boundary in the zone of increasing risk. Agriculture. That is really a big driver. There's a beautiful paper done by a group at Oxford University saying, look at the planetary boundaries and say, what is the impact of agriculture on all those boundaries? And when you do that, you see that for most of them, for biodiversity, biosphere integrity, land system change, freshwater use, phosphorus, nitrogen, it is the major driver by far of change in the planetary boundaries. It's significant in climate change, but not as big as fossil fuels. So again, this just highlights that if we're going to become sustainable, if we're going to achieve better outcomes from the biosphere, we actually have to transform agriculture. We can't just fiddle it. We actually have to transform it and make it quite a different operation. Again, just in summary on the planetary boundaries then, what we're really aiming to do is influence the trajectory of the Earth system. So right now, if you look at this as change in the Earth system, safe space, uncertainty zone, high risk, we're somewhere up here in the uncertainty zone if you try to integrate all nine boundaries. But we're on a strong trajectory up into the high risk zone. High risk zone for stability of the planet, high risk zone for viability of human civilizations, and certainly a high risk zone for the biosphere. There's no doubt if we go up here, we will actually achieve the sixth great extinction event in Earth history. So the planetary boundaries are simply designed to say where along this trajectory do you absolutely need to stop and bend it down, and give guideposts, numbers, processes that we really need to look after, to keep under control, if we want to stabilize the Earth before these feedbacks get it out of control. I'm going to conclude now just with some comments from colleagues of mine who are not natural scientists. It's outside of my area of expertise. But one of the things I run into all the time when people talk to me about this, challenge me about this, and very quickly say, what can I do or what should we do? Well, that gets outside the natural science zone pretty quickly. So the solutions lie elsewhere in the humanities, the social sciences, and so on. This book I would highly recommend. It's called Donut Economics, written by Kate Raworth at Oxford University. And it's the first book, I think, that really fundamentally challenges our economic system and says, this is really the big problem. is we have to redesign the economic system so that it does this. These are the planetary boundaries. That's the outside of Kate's donut. The inside is human well-being, the things we care about as humans, social equality, gender equality, food, water, income, and so on. But we need to have a well-functioning biosphere and geosphere to be able to deliver that. And it's that space in between the ceiling of the planetary boundaries and the social foundation is where we want to be. This is why she calls it donut economics. But she says she has seven guidelines for this. I only put three of them. These are the three I think are really core. Systems thinking, dynamic complexity. We have to get out of this really, really simple neoliberal economic model that's just simply profit-oriented and has a very simple view of both planet Earth and of humans. It has to deliver equity for human societies. And it has to do it by design, not as an accident. It has to be designed to deliver equity, income equality, other aspects of equity. And this is really important, she emphasizes, the biosphere. It actually has to be regenerative. Now, every economist I talk to doesn't get this. When they see the biosphere, the first word that pops up is resource. I say, no. You need to rethink so that the economic system is designed to protect and regenerate, not to exploit. And that's a profound change in how we think about an economic system and how we think about the biosphere. So the challenge is this. This is the famous sort of triple bottom line. We have biosphere, we have humans as part of the biosphere, and of course we have an economy. But what's happened over time is that the economy has taken over, and that's the number one priority in most countries around the world now, pretty much globally. So how do we change this? Well, if you're going to change the economy, if you're going to do what Kate wants, you actually have to shift core values that underlie who we are and what we do. There's been a lot written about that. I'm just going to close with a couple of colleagues of mine who put it much more eloquently than I do. This is Dipash Chakrabarty. He's a philosopher. University of Chicago sometimes comes to ANU in Canberra. And he just summarized it really quickly. He said, look, the problem is we have built, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, a human-centric society. It's all about humans. It's all about wealth. It's all about consumption. It's all about us. And he said, the Anthropocene demands a life-centric, a zoocentric approach. There's this wonderful phrase here, we have to get out of departmental thinking. We're all stovepiped into different departments. That's certainly true in academia. And we have to have epochal consciousness. We're in a new epoch. We humans have to take some responsibility for this now and become stewards of the planet rather than exploiters of the planet. That's what he talks about. My good colleague and friend Carl Folke, whom many of you may know, across the Baltic in Stockholm, he puts it just in four words. What's our challenge this century? It's to reconnect to the biosphere. We evolved in the biosphere. We're part of the biosphere. And yet we've disconnected ourselves from it and are now in the process of exploiting it and degrading it. We need to reconnect with it. So the last word I'm going to give to my countrymen in Australia, the Indigenous Australians, who arguably have had the longest intact culture on the planet, over 60,000 years, managing an entire continent. And they have a really simple but powerful philosophy, which is the reason they're put there is to look after country. That's their role. Notice they had a systems approach. We're only a tool in the cycle of things. They talked about cycles and systems. We go out into the world, help keep the balance of nature. It's a big cycle. There's that cycle again. It's a big cycle of living with the land and then eventually going back to it. So there's a lot of knowledge out there that we've left behind from indigenous cultures, from academia and so on. But that's our challenge in the Anthropocene, is how do we make the Anthropocene one of stewardship rather than one of exploitation. So hopefully that's given you a little bit to think about and to talk about, and hopefully all the combined knowledge of the people here about how we should look after the biosphere, hopefully we can get that front and center of in our political system. So thanks very much for your attention. Happy to have some questions and discussion.
Thank you very much for an insightful talk. We have time for discussion, so any questions and comments to Will?
There's one over back there.
Oh yeah, way up the pole.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. I'm Sean Sigsted from Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and I have a question for you. What do you think are the best tools that we can explore to transform our worldview to a worldview more biological?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm not the right person to answer it. You need to talk to some of these people I put in the last couple slides, ethicists, philosophers, and so on. I can't give you a good answer of how you change human values other than to say that there seems to be a shift occurring, particularly with younger generations now in many parts of the world, toward this sort of thinking. It's certainly coming through, for example, in dietary changes and so on. The positive thing I would say is that just like any other sphere in the Earth system, not any other, but many spheres in the Earth system, I think human systems have tipping points too, and they can happen quite fast. Just a couple decades ago, everyone thought, well, you'd never get smoking out of pubs and restaurants. Well, it flipped, and now no one would ever think of doing that. But I see a groundswell of support for people who recognize what the problem is, that we have a core value system that isn't serving us well and certainly isn't serving the biosphere or the geosphere well, and we need to change. I can see it in my country, certainly in terms of a lot of support now for changing the way we do things, but we're fighting a big fossil fuel industry, which influences the political system. But you get tipping points along the way. So my hope is that we hit a social tipping point, hopefully within the next decade or so, where it just becomes, well, why didn't we do this before? You know, why aren't we changing agriculture? Why are we burning fossil fuels? So let's hope that we get that tipping point within the next decade or so.
Over
there. Hi, thank you very much for your talk and for coming to talk to conservationists. There has been a discourse that has been emerging with the Anthropocene that kind of take on board Anthropocene as something positive, and instead of having a discourse of humility, there is the discourse of mastery, that we are becoming the masters of the earth and we should be proud of it, and technology is going to save us and innovation is going to make us the masters. How do you answer to that discourse and how do you react to it?
Okay. Yeah, that's the so-called good Anthropocene. It's often called the good Anthropocene. And it's, we're in charge now, baby, we're going to drive this planet sort of way of thinking about it. And we respond, I think, quite appropriately as Earth system scientists saying, listen, everything you're proposing is the good Anthropocene is exactly the stuff that got us into trouble in the first place. And no one's been able to cogently respond to that. The techno-optimists say, oh yes, we'll come up with something and so on. But all the evidence from Earth system science is saying that's not the right approach at all. So that, fortunately, is a minority approach, as far as I can see. But it is a dangerous one in terms of saying, well, this is probably a good thing rather than a cause for worry.
Zofia Prokop, Jagiellonian University from Poland. I think words are really important, and I've realized recently that I'm worrying about some of the terms that we are using in the discourse. So one example is anthropocentrism itself, because when you think about it, it suggests that we're putting humans in the center. But when you get into specifics, it actually appears it's not humans, it's some humans, or maybe, like you showed, it's actually the money rather than our species. So, and another term is nature conservation, which I think we're all using a lot, but in a way it also suggests the distinction or divide between us and nature. So nature is something that we protect. So I'm just trying to think about how and whether we should try to redesign the way we talk about these things.
Yeah, look, that's a really good point. Two things I think you raised. One is the word Anthropocene, and of course Paul Crutzen uttered that because of the anthropos, meaning human, gets attached to a lot of suffixes, and scene being the geological term. So yeah, there's anthropocentric thoughts and so on. I don't know how you get around that. I think the Anthropocene is taken off because it has the capacity to encompass so many facets of a really complex idea in one word. And so that's what I think the power is. And it is interpreted in many different ways. The second one, though, I think is really important. And again, that last slide I showed you, in fact, I might even go back to it, that one. Is that a natural landscape? No. It's been farmed with fire sticks for about 60,000 years. Okay. As far as we can tell, it's in very good condition. There may have been some species loss early on in terms of megafauna. There's a debate in Australia whether it was indigenous Australians or whether it was extremely cold, dry periods or a combination of both, which led to that. But when Europeans came to Australia in the late 1700s, they thought that this was some great pristine wilderness. In fact, the entire continent, particularly the eastern side of that continent, had been basically managed, gardened, looked after as one huge estate. So humans have been part of the biosphere for a long, long, long time. And so that raises a really interesting issue, particularly with regard to indigenous peoples, is what really is the natural world or nature. And what isn't. The easiest way to get around that, of course, is we are Homo sapiens. We are part of the biosphere. We evolved into the biosphere. We've been living and interacting with the biosphere as fully modern humans for 200,000 years, as hominids for maybe 3 million. The question now is in these last few slides, we've actually broken that connection that we should have with the biosphere. That's where the problem is, and it's even more fundamental than trying to judge whether something is really natural and setting aside. It's how do we actually live in harmony with the biosphere? That's really what we've got to get at. And the Anthropocene is just a manifestation of the fact that we've completely broken our bonds with the biosphere and are going off and doing some pretty bizarre things with our lives.
Any further questions?
Yeah, short comment, because, you know, sometimes I thought what's the difference between humans being and other beings in the earth. And then I thought that the one of the things which distinguish us for very, very long, longer than 18th century or so, is this, that we are able to store and use energy. What any being in the earth cannot do this. So it's from the fire use, as you show, to fossil fuels, then nuclear energy. So we are very, very away from the other species and quite distinguished. So this doesn't make me optimistic, to be honest.
We
can be anytime in harmony with the nature.
Yeah, look, you're right, but I think the break point really was developing fossil fuels. I mean, if you look at the Australian landscape and do the thought experiment that you don't have Indigenous Australians there, you still get fires. You know, as we say, whether it's black lightning or white lightning, it still gets the savanna going. So the Indigenous Australians were clever enough to learn. They didn't start fire, they managed fire. But they learned how nature managed fire in that savanna, and mimic that pretty much. And I think indigenous cultures around the world pre-fossil fuels had a much better sense, and they were very limited in the energy they could commandeer. So it wasn't a big change to the way the earth operated. It was when we got this fossilized energy, this fossilized net primary productivity, which took millions of years to build up, and we burn it in a century too. That was a break point, and I agree with you on that. So the real question for us, I think, is not that we go back and live like indigenous cultures. I don't think we'll ever do that, and we can't with 7 billion people. So how do we live more in sync with the way planet Earth operates and use our technology really, really smartly? And that requires that shift I'm talking about, away from the bottom line being how wealthy you can get and how much you can consume, is to how you can live a really good life with better equity amongst humans and more in harmony with the way the biosphere in the Earth system operates. And that requires a value shift. It doesn't mean you abandon all the technology, but you just have to be really smart about how you use it.
I think Piero is next.
I think the planetary boundary is a really powerful framework, and I applaud you for your work. I've got a question that is more technical, is about the biodiversity integrity indicator. I understand BII is an interim indicator.
Yes.
In the quest for something that is more supported by evidence.
Yes.
Have you got some thoughts about what that could be, since there is no evidence that actually BII, at least local BII, is a good proxy for loss in ecosystem function, at least not at the planetary scale?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, BII is an interim indicator. It's based on expert knowledge, expert elicitation. So it's not a, it's sort of a fuzzy indicator in that regard. No, we're still open, and we're hoping that the biological sciences, the biosphere experts can help us with coming up with what a good indicator might be, how you measure the integrity of the biosphere. We had one workshop, and that was that Mace et al. Paper came out of that, which came up with some interesting ideas which may need to be developed a bit further, but we haven't gotten there yet. That's a good criticism, because the biosphere integrity boundary is with climate change. Those are the two most important boundaries. Climate change is pretty easy. You know, we've got a measure of radiative forcing, but we need to do much better on the biosphere. So I can't tell you we've solved it, but I can tell you we're actively looking at good ideas.
Thank you very much for an extremely powerful, I won't say wonderful, but powerful talk. My name is Leif Schulman. I'm from the Finnish Museum of Natural History. So among other things, I'm in the business of public education on science and environmental issues. I very often come across this thought that we should focus on the younger generation. You know, we should make sure that the younger generation, school kids, visit us and get the message about the problems in the biosphere and so on. You also now mentioned the younger generation, and you said hopefully within a decade or so. But this makes me uneasy, and it makes me more and more uneasy every year, actually, since at the same time you speak about very narrow time windows before we reach tipping points. So I don't think we can really wait for a social tipping point coming about with the younger generation changing its behavior. We should be able to change how we, you and I, middle-aged guys who rule the world, basically, how we change our behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. look, it's just I'm a bit skeptical, because I deal a lot in my life with middle-aged old white men. And it doesn't give me a lot of hope. One of the really good trends, in addition to young people, is getting a lot more women involved in various important roles in society, and that may really help get us over the tipping point. I had the great pleasure of bumping into the new New Zealand Prime Minister the day that she was sworn in as PM. Just by chance, I was at the same restaurant in Wellington where she was having her party. And that's the sort of person you look to because she's not bound by any of the conventional wisdom of politics. And within, I don't know how many months, Jacinda Ardern's been in, but she's already, for the first time, got agriculture into the carbon pricing system in New Zealand, which was sacrosanct before that. She's going to stop offshore drilling, all sorts of things like that, which people said weren't politically possible. But she's a very persuasive person, and I think she's going to use that first year of goodwill to actually ram a lot of stuff through. So you start to see signs of hope, but they don't come from us old white fellows, unfortunately.
I think now it's a fair point to give the last and final question to a lady.
Okay, thank you. Yes, my comment is that it seems there are parallel discourses now going on in public. One is that you described is the damage. The other is unprecedented social progress that have been done in the same time. As a woman, I would say I can feel it. I have very low risk to die in childbirth. My children survive infancy and so on and so forth. We are more equal than ever before. And there are many, many data that prove it. But these things are disconnected in public debate again. I think we have to put them together somehow, because if we keep to this, we don't sell it well enough, because we don't want to lose that social, you know, progress and benefit. We don't, I think, want to go to that what you call sustainable indigenous lifestyle, because this is where child mortality was very high, because they were subjected to natural population control.
Yeah.
So could you
respond? No, good point. I think I did say we would never go back and live like that, but there are some values and principles that could help guide us in how we interact with the biosphere. The social one's really tricky. Again, I'm speaking not really as an expert, because I'm not a social scientist. But there are a lot of positive things that have happened. You've pointed them out. But at the same time, since about 1980, there's been growing inequality in the wealthy countries of the world, which are leading to all sorts of social problems as well as social progress. So we've got a real equity inequality issue to deal with as well. And that's I think it's a mixed bag socially. I think what's happening, particularly recently in terms of more equity between women and men, is really, really positive. And there are a lot of social benefits that come from that. But on the other hand, at the same time, in the same societies, you see a growing inequality, and you're seeing bad social outcomes because of that as well. I'll give you another statistic that strikes me as being really interesting. Right now in the world, we've managed to really get hunger and malnutrition down. It's under 1 billion out of 7.5 billion people. It's around 800 million people are now malnourished. That's way too many, but it's gone down. But at the same time, there are over 2 billion people that are overweight, obese, and suffering from micronutrient deficiencies. So, yeah, we've done a lot of good things, but there are still some fundamental flaws in the way we organize ourselves. And there's a real problem, tension between delivering the good things that you quite rightly point out, but delivering increasing problems that we also need to recognize.
Okay, I think it's now time to thank Will again for a very powerful and thought-provoking talk.
Thank you.
Now it's time to start wrapping up this Congress, and now I would like to ask Society for Conservation Biology Global and Europe section on stage, please.
Well, hello, everybody, at least those one who stick till the very end. And now we have the highlight of the conference, which is, of course, our student presentation and poster awards. But before, I would just like to thank to everybody who submitted their posters and orals. We were in a tough situation because we did receive a lot of outstanding work, and this gave us all a chance to actually discuss with each other and found out about new research areas, because it was diverse areas that were actually covered. So the work of our judges was not really easy. Altogether, there were 108 presentations, and I would like to thank, give a special thanks to our judges who actually contributed a lot of their time sitting on your presentations and making unbiased, very objective, and very based on very variety of criterion evaluation.
Thank you. So I would also like to recognize the sponsors for the Student Awards. So Cambridge University Press, as well as Oxford University Press, have supported this. And our winners, the awardees, will all receive one book of their choice from one of those press sponsors. In addition, third place winners will receive a one-year membership to SCB. Second place winners will receive a two-year membership, and first place winners will receive a three-year membership to the society. So, nice awards there. Okay, so we are going to start with our poster awardees. Do you have the clicker? We need a clicker to do that, though. Okay, so I'm going to start with that. For our student poster awards, our third place is Emini Neiman. And I said that wrong. Neiman. Are you here? Come on up. There you go. Emini Neiman. Congratulations. And we're going to go to second place. This is a little easier for me to pronounce. I'm sorry. Andrea Lang, are you here? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody get up, so if there's somebody here that knows Andrea and can relay this to her, we'll be glad to do that. Otherwise, we'll send it to her. And then for first place for posters, Lovisa Nielsen. Are you here? Lovisa, there you go.
Okay, and now we are just following the three awards for the presentations. So the third place would go to Di Jiang. I do apologize if I am not pronouncing the name. But okay. The second awardee is William Morgan. Okay, and the final and the first awardee is Tahnail Hoki.
Okay, again, I'm not seeing this individual, so if anybody here would like to accept this and bring it, that's fine. Okay. Thank you all.
Well, thank you all for your brilliant work, as I said in the beginning, and this conference really provided us and used us as a platform to maybe develop some new research ideas and new activities, and I can say, at least from my side and myself, that I really, it was really stimulating and motivating. And thank you once again.
And congratulations to all the awardees. Thank you. You want me to go? Is this on? Okay, I'm just going to go. No, I'm not. I'm going to come out here. So I'm just going to say a couple of words. We're trying to close up, and I know that. I know Begay wants to speak, and I wanted to share with you a couple of my impressions from this week. So I am extremely impressed by what I've seen here this week. This is my first section conference with SCB, so you get to be the winners of the first. But from the board to the local organizing committees to all the volunteers in the yellow shirts that have been working so hard, to all of you and your go ahead. Yeah, they were working really hard. To all of the posters and the presentations and the keynote plenaries. This has been a wonderful week for me. I've learned an awful lot from you. I'm going to try to use music to break up every single talk like you did here. I think that was phenomenal. I don't know who thought of that, but awesome idea. And so this was really beneficial for me to get to know you. I got to know several of you. Hopefully tonight at the dinner you'll come and talk to me. I'll get to know more of you. But I got a really good feel for this section and some of the obvious successes and some of the things that we can do as a global organization to work more hand in hand. So one thing I would like to say before I turn this over to Begay is, Will, your talk, I will say, was powerful. Again, I won't say positive because, man, it left me feeling, I'm getting emotional just talking about it. But I think that one comment that came up was the old male in the room, the white male, the white stale male in the room. And while we can talk about, don't forget women, we need to think about inclusivity and diversity all the way around. So your point is we are one planet, we are one system, we are one community. And that's what SCB is about, is one community. And how do we work across this whole globe to do something about this? And I'm not sure anybody knows the answer, but I think people are the problems, and people are the answers. So I wanted to leave you with something positive because that left me feeling, ooh, I don't know. So my last thing I'm gonna say is an invitation to come next year to Kuala Lumpur. This is where our 29th International Congress is going to be for the Society for Conservation Biology. I'm actually leaving here and flying there and doing a site visit, so I'll know more about it once I'm done. I can't tell you a whole lot, but I do know it's going to be in Kuala Lumpur, and we're hoping that all of you will join us. And if you're not already a member of SCB, I hope this week will help you think about joining SCB and becoming a member of this wonderful section here. So thank you all for your hospitality.
So, dear planet saviors, have you learned something? Was it worthwhile? Yeah. I rephrase my question. Did you have fun? I think you need a party tonight to really get that right. At least I've had fun, great fun. I learned a lot. So, actually, first of all, I would like to thank all of you for actually coming here and sharing your exciting research and the knowledge that you have gained. I mean, this is really what it is about, that we learn from each other. So that's really great fun. And of course, I also have to again express the gratitude from the Europe section of Society for Conservation Biology to all the great local people. I knew it would work fantastically well, but still, you know, seeing it happen is fantastic. So a really big thank for from the society to your large work and your help in this. So it's a bit sad that it's over, but I think, yeah. So yes, it's a bit sad that it's over, but I think that most of us leave here with a lot of new energy and ideas for and sort of things that we want to do after being here. And you know, 3 years fly fast, and I guess that means that we will soon meet again at the ECCB in 2021. So you better hurry up going home, do some nice, exciting research so that you have something to present next time we actually meet. You cannot come with your old presentations. We want to have new stuff when we meet. So until then, good luck with your work and continue supporting conservation biology and, yes, saving our planet. Goodbye.
Okay, it's me again. I'm emotional. Those who you don't know me, I'm Mikko Mönkkönen, and I have had the privilege of being the chair of the local organizing committee. One of the concepts that have popped out during this meeting is no net loss. And as we heard, that it means that if Atte Moilanen takes 50 euros from Professor Kotiaho, Kotiaho should take it back immediately, otherwise it's going to be net loss. And it should be 50 euros, not 50 crowns. Or perhaps more generally, if we give something away, we should get a reward that is at least of the same size as your cost. For me personally, I feel that this Congress has fulfilled the criteria of no net loss. I have invested some time and resources over the past few years to this Congress, but I feel that I'm getting back more than I have invested. I have had an opportunity to work with a team of very devoted people, the local organizing committee and the Congress assistants, and also steering committee and the European section of the society. And that has been a super positive experience for me. During this Congress, I have met old friends and made new friends. I have heard good science, learned new things. And so I think I have gained more than I invested. Similarly, I hope that you who spent your time and money coming to Jyväskylä, I'm deeply honored and happy that you invested your time, and also from the budget perspective, I'm relieved that you you spent your time and money to come to Jyväskylä. And I sincerely hope that this is a no net loss Congress for you, so that you feel that you have gained more than you have spent. On Tuesday, we had a press conference in this very same room, and one of the journalists made a question whether we have any positive news to deliver, because we conservation scientists, we are considered of having just sad news. We are losing planet's biodiversity, we are losing habitats, and we are threatening human well-being. But during this Congress, I think it became obvious that even though the state of the planet is not very good, and we have a formidable task ahead of us. If we want to save the planet's biodiversity, we conservation scientists, we do have at least some solutions to offer. We do have solutions, we do know some ways how to do things in a more sustainable way. And we do have some means to save populations from declining, and we know at least to some extent how to reconcile our economy with the economy of the nature, if we so wish. So I think we conservation scientists are much more than just prophets of the doomsday. So let's continue our efforts of being part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Let's keep up the hope, be active, not only in doing good science, but also active in networking with other actors in conservation, administration, politicians, NGOs, and local people. One thing I learned during this Congress is that personal contacts with other people often have a larger conservation impact than a peer-reviewed science paper. But because our argumentation and our talk is based on scientific facts, we should and we are much more than a bunch of manic street preachers. Luckily, we have an opportunity tonight to listen to true manic street preachers here in Jyväskylä today. So soon we will have an opportunity to go to Satamanyö Festival and enjoy good music, including the manic street preachers. I have been chairing a local organizing committee, which I said was a very rewarding task. I feel strongly that I have been more like a moon, just reflecting back the light that the sun has emitted. So the little yellow suns, the local organizing committee, and the Congress assistant, please come over here. I would like to thank you all. Come on. Okay, time for final housekeeping notes. Satamanyö Festival will start at 7 p.m. and the gates will be open 15 minutes earlier. So please be there at 8 p.m. at the latest. And unfortunately, according to Finnish law, no person under 18 years of age is allowed in the festival area. So if you have kids with you, and you have bought a ticket to Satamanyö, and you would still like to participate, we have organized it so that there will be childcare to your kids, with trained personnel to look after our future planet killers. So, if you have kids with you and you would like to come to Satamanyö, please go to information desk right after this. And the childcare will be available till 9 p.m. And you have to pick your kids at 9 p.m. Thank you and welcome.